Hello, I'm Dr. Felix Beecher, and this is the Medical AI Podcast, a 30-minute thrill ride of big ideas. We talk to a range of top guests, from industry innovators to scientists to philosophers. This is brought to you by Informatech, where I'm the head of healthcare technology. One of the most exciting aspects of medical AI is the unlimited variety of ways in which machine learning can be applied to healthcare problems. This means that sometimes one comes across medical AI systems which do things that one never would have thought of. And today I'm really delighted to introduce a startup company which is definitely one of those. I have with me here Narinder Singh, CEO at Look Deep Health. Narinder, a very, very warm welcome. I'm really thrilled to have you here.
Thanks, Felix. I'm thrilled to be here.
Excellent. All right, well, let's start off with just an introduction of yourself and some explanation about what it is that Look Deep Health does.
Great. So my story begins, I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, moved out to the Valley during the first dot-com bubble transformation, and spent a career in enterprise technology helping big companies adopt technologies like the internet, then cloud computing. My last company was the first investment that Salesforce had ever made in the space. And so as that company was fortunate enough to grow and sell, I was looking for something else to think about doing. And I decided to get into healthcare, went back to school and did a master's with a bunch of 20-somethings in translational medicine. And then I had my real education in healthcare. My mom had interstitial lung disease, and she went in for a biopsy into the hospital to try to discover what branch. After what appeared to be a successful biopsy, she crashed and developed a breathing condition, ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome, and was immediately put on a trach, a breathing tube, and we were in a crisis. And so all of a sudden, we walked in expecting to walk out in 2 days, and we were there for 12 weeks on a journey that had her qualifying for a lung transplant, being placed on ECMO, which helps you oxygenate your blood and take the function of your lungs, and eventually having a bilateral lung transplant and a series of surgeries to correct various infections. All in, she was there 12 weeks, and I was there for 1,000 hours. And I was shocked at the miracle of medicine, things like ECMO that literally take the function of your lungs over temporarily, to how poorly technology supported the practice of caring for these patients. You're stunned when you're in the hospital and you realize that the doctor's in your room 5 or 10 minutes a day, and the nurses, have anywhere from 1 to 3 patients in the ICU or 5 or 6 or 7 patients on the floor of the hospital. And so you just realize how much time you are not observed. And you see all the wires connected and you think there must be something here, that data is all we need. But the truth is, and if you ask any doctor or nurse, there's so much information that's only available if you can see the patient, be there with them. And I saw that manifest itself again and again and started thinking about, well, why can't a nurse just be with my mom all the time? Why can't the whole team? My favorite nurse was this woman named Meg, who I hope to see again sometime. She was wonderful because she was caring and compassionate, but also when she didn't have other patients, she was very good at spotting problems before they became serious issues. And in a case as complicated as my mom, 1,000 things had to go right for her to be able to be healthy and recovering 4.5 years later, holding her grandkids. And so I started thinking about how can we make that experience real? How can we put Meg in my mom's room, in every mom's room all the time? And so we started looking at using a camera with artificial intelligence, computer vision, to see the patient all the time so that we could constantly monitor what was happening to them and support nurses and doctors in observing and caring for those patients. So that's the thesis of our company and how we're trying to change healthcare in hospitals today.
Okay, how's your mom doing at the moment, by the way?
We're all 4.5 years after. I have a 4-year-old and a 7-month-old, so it's one of the joys of my life to get her to see her hold those kids right. Thanks to the successful journey. So she's
doing
great.
Good for you. I mean, look, we see these kind of paradox everywhere in healthcare, right? On the one hand, we have technology that is almost miraculous. We have lots of physicians and nurses who are very skilled and great people. And then we just have, beside that, you know, just wasted data and dysfunction and missed opportunities. And I guess that's what we're trying to bring together, right? Also, I have to mention, normally when somebody mentions Megan and AI in the same breath, it's usually about that film with the nightmare doll, right? And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about one of life's real saints in healthcare.
I've committed to never name our AI any name, but I love what Meg did for my mom, but I think it would be diminishing her memory to try to name AI for what she was able to do that only she was able to do.
Absolutely. Okay, so what we're trying to do here is essentially replicate these, you know, the wonderful things that healthcare professionals do, but in a way that makes them more numerous, more efficient, and so forth, to kind of cover this gap in healthcare between demand and the, you know, our ability to treat people, right?
Absolutely. And the way to think about it is, a lot of times when people hear AI, they think about it taking over a decision for a doctor or a nurse. And that was really our first unlocking principle, which is like, let's not try to take over the decision. Let's try to give the decision makers better information. So if you're, so through our technology, this camera in the room, what we're trying to do is say, I'm going to make it so that you virtually can experience what was happening with the patient.
Yeah.
Were they still in the middle of the night? Were they restless in the middle of the night? Were they not moving at all for the last hour since you've seen them? How do we fill in the gaps so that you as a nurse or a doctor have better information so you can apply your unique expertise to the patient, every patient that you have, so you can essentially be everywhere at once?
Okay. All right. So at the moment, we have the problem that patients are not really properly surveilled, because doctors and nurses can't be everywhere all the time. Could you somehow quantify the magnitude of that problem? How does it, how does that translate into, I don't know, mortality and morbidity?
Let me give, I'm going to sandwich the statistics on a very macro and a very micro level. At a macro level, the population is aging. We all know that. And so that means that, like, the number of seniors in the United States alone will double in the next 40 years. So that's the number of people 65 and older will grow from 50 million to 100 million. So what that means is the average patient in the hospital, simply by fact of aging and many other factors as well, is becoming sicker, more acute. So you've got rising problem there. On the other side, what COVID exposed is that nurses and doctors are more burnt out than ever. Nurse turnover in the hospital has risen to 22%. So 22% of nurses leave. The average intent to leave is 41%. So 41% of nurses working in hospitals today are intending to leave the profession, not just their employer. And it has a financial impact as well. One percentage point change, so that 22% turnover, each point of that is worth about $380,000 a year to the average hospital. So you have massive financial incentives. You have massive pressure on staff, and you've got a sicker patient population. So essentially what we're trying to do is tackle this imbalance between attention on patients and what we're looking at with an aging population. And there's the closest statistics that you would find to this is that there's many statistics that show a better nursing ratio, like 1-5 versus 1-7, results in better care and outcomes for patients. Now, yeah, we're a long way from proving that we can completely, you know, bridge that ratio, but that's really the target for us.
Okay, good. So let's drill down into what your product actually is. Can you describe it in detail? How it works? You know, where the cameras are, what kind of diseases your, you know, these systems are trained on. Can you flesh that out a bit?
Absolutely. So there's a few things to note. One is that there's too many AI solutions that are a solution running, searching for a problem. And so the deployment of, here's a new sensor, a new thing, there's too many new things that make it hard to actually get into practice. So for us, part one was to make it so that we could get it where people already were used to using video. So what we have is a device that, you know, we'll send you a picture of. It looks like a square. It's two cameras, an audio capability. It can be an all-in-one solution that just sits on a shelf or is mounted on a cart or is put on top of the TV. So it's a, think of it as a camera plus a computer, essentially. And that solution provides core telemedicine services. So even before we get to our AI, hospitals can use it for virtual visits or for monitoring scenarios that they're already employing today. And we're just doing it cheaper. We're giving away the hardware because we care about the AI problem more. The magic of what we do is to say, we take not only allow you to do your current scenarios, but we supercharge them with AI. Okay, what do you mean? So what we're looking at is a few factors. The first of all is that we're looking at the patient. So we're saying, even if you're in bed, how much are you moving? Are you moving 60 times a minute? Are you moving 2 times a minute? And again, you can imagine understanding that information and the time of day or what medications you're on starts to provide you additional insight for the hospital. Because so many times, you're like, they were in bed all day. But what does that mean? It has tons of implications for their reactions to medications, their likelihood to have the energy for physical therapy in the morning, their ability to be at risk for pressure injury. So we're tracking movement, even if they're just sitting in bed, almost like a wearable without the wearable. The second thing we're doing is tracking their location overall. Are they in bed all day? Are they sitting in the chair? Are they walking around the room? And as you can expect, most patients go through this cycle where they're in bed a lot. And as they get better, they eventually start to be in bed less and less, and then they recover. And you can imagine looking at a cluster of patients, like everybody who had a hip surgery on Monday, how do they look on that arc of being in bed all day to being active and ready to be discharged? And then the other component we look at is the care activity. How many times are nurses visiting? How much time and activity are at their bedside? There's a large set of things around. We interrupt patients too much at night, making it hard for them to sleep. But until now, hospitals have had no way of really measuring that except doing things like auditing actions. So those are just three examples of things that we do right now. But essentially, we have it's like laying the cable, and now we're adding channels. So things we're working on now is, how many times are they eating? Are there compression stockings on? Is the bed flat or not? These are all things that quality programs in hospitals seek to understand and improve practice of. And we can look at those on an individual basis and prompt nurses and doctors for what's happening, and then aggregate that information to help hospitals measure how well their quality improvement initiatives are working.
And so, is this a general technique that can be applied to any kind of patient, or do you only want to apply it to particular types of patients?
So I would say the core answer is it should apply to every kind of patient. The more specific answer is, the better we can cluster patients, the more actionable the AI insights are. So for example, like my mom, if I was showing you only patients who are trached and have a respiratory condition, I can tune the AI to prompt more appropriately. Like I can say things like, hey, I'm going to look for, did the trach slip out of your neck, which sounds the same in the room as the small cuff that measures oxygen falling off of your finger. Or the hip surgery example, if I can look at only patients with hip surgery, they should have a more similar trajectory. So the techniques apply globally, but the insights get much richer as we can narrow it to more specific patient populations.
Okay, so when you talk about those kind of examples, are you... referring to the kind of systems that you already have in place, or is this more of an ambition about the kind of things that you could develop in the future?
Closer to an ambition, because we don't have the clusters of patient populations. The number of patients we're doing are a little bit more general, so we don't have 1,000 patients that had a hip surgery on Monday that we can measure through yet, but we will. So we're looking at things a little bit more generically, like how do the patients rest overnight? This is a canonical problem in hospitals. We all know that rest is important to recovery for all patients, but we have no real way of measuring that in the hospital. Nurses kind of peek their head in a few times, and they are guessing, like, how was the night for the patient? We can objectively look at minute by minute, how much was the patient moving? We can look at how many interruptions they had. So we're using today these more generic techniques that apply for generic problems like sleep, or the inverse of sleep during the day is risk for pressure injury. If you're in bed all day and not moving very much, your risk is higher. Most hospitals will say you need to be turned every couple of hours. Is that happening? So we're using the same techniques for more general problems that apply to broad patient population, and then we'll narrow over time.
Okay, so let's take the example of somebody who's recovering from some kind of surgery, and let's imagine that this camera is trained on them both during the night and during the day as well. Now, the way I'm imagining it, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that I guess at some point a nurse or a doctor will come in and be able to see, you know, some kind of summary data on sleep, on activity. I mean, what would that summary data look like?
Yeah. So this is a very important topic that you've unlocked. We're very proud. We've got 4 years of research data on our AI solutions. And the one thing that we realized is it's not good enough. It's not good enough to print it out and say, go run to this room. This patient has this going on for two reasons. One is the patient population is diverse. Second is we don't have access to every piece of healthcare data that the doctor or nurse does. So what we did from day one is said human plus AI is greater than AI. So our usage scenarios today involve canonically a virtual nurse or a virtual doctor looking at a large population of patients and our AI nudging their attention to certain patients, and then that virtual provider using the EHR, radiology imaging, or just the history of the patient to say, now I can make a decision. Let me be more specific. So in the context of your surgical recovery person, we may be looking at every patient in the hospital and say, I'm going to show you the patients that are at a higher risk for pressure injury because they're in bed and they're not moving very much. Mm-hmm. And now you can, Mr. or Mrs. Nurse or Doctor, look at those patients virtually, look at our AI charts that show, go look in their EHR for their medications or their history or into the notes, and then you can instantly video visit them or contact the bedside team to do something. So we are using our AI to nudge the attention of this nurse or doctor towards a set of patients that we're just looking at high, medium, low, which ones are the highest risk for the conditions you already care about and the protocols you already have in place to deal with those conditions. So we're essentially turning this virtual nurse into Iron Man or Iron Woman, not trying to fully create an autonomous AI that tells you what to do right now.
Okay, so I mean, in practice, how does it work? Like, for example, if a doctor or nurse comes in one morning for their shift, I mean, do these kind of data on a particular patient come up on some kind of centralized computer system, or do they have to go to the room and like look at some kind of laptop there? I mean, how does that kind of side of it work?
Two aspects. A little bit of this is dependent upon the health system's own clinical workflows. So on something like the morning rounds, where hospital doctors and nurses will round on patients, that's a place where we can insert our data through the EHR into their summary of data, which is, hey, here's what their pattern of movement looked like overnight, or here's a fingerprint of what their overnight period looked like. That could help give them context or information on what sleep looks like. So we're running a study right now with Duke around related topics. But the other part of this is that they already have so much information. And so rather than trying to place that information into the hand of every doctor and nurse all the time, this is where that virtual provider comes through. And they're just in our system all day being nudged to look at certain patients. Here's the 17 patients that had a bad night last night. Let's look at their medications. Let's look at their pieces. Let's video visit some of them. And so that service provider essentially together with our AI becomes a guardian angel for the bedside team. So we look at supporting things like virtual nursing and to support the bedside team directly, not trying to overwhelm the bedside team with more data, especially at this stage of evolution. It's much more like driver assist in the car versus trying to create a full self-driving healthcare system with the state of the technology's capabilities right now.
So it sounds like the nurse or the doctor is going to be is going to come to the data, right? They're going to, if they're doing their round, then they will have a look at the data on a particular patient. Or are there cases where your systems would actively highlight some kind of alarm to the doctor or nurse?
So this is, we try not to highlight an alarm to the bedside nurse or doctor. And the reason for that is that even if we were 99% accurate, we're going to have so many false alarms that we're just contributing to this problem of alarm fatigue that's been well researched. But by going through the virtual nurse and saying, Mr. or Mrs. Hospital Administrator, we are going to make your virtual nurses better at supporting the bedside team. Now the change management, the interface for the bedside nurse is another nurse. And that other nurse can see the data. They're used to looking at it. It's not a distraction for them. It's a core technique that they're using to look at the EHR data and our data to provide broader surveillance over the whole patient population. So this is actually really important because we think the AI aspects of what we have are important, but the integration into clinical workflow to not disrupt existing workflow is critical. Nurses and doctors today, there's yet another survey every week. They don't trust AI in the hospital. And for good reason. We started with things like Watson, which really reduced trust overall. But it's also because the claims are too far ahead. And so they don't trust AI. So your AI has to be excellent to alert them indirectly. And also, even if it is, there's still a trust factor. Whereas if we can train the virtual nurse or the virtual doctor to be the interface to that bedside nurse or bedside doctor, it's a much more effective change management mechanism to get the insights from AI to make the entire clinical workflow more productive, not just try to spit out an answer.
Okay, now AI systems, of course, rely very, very heavily on how they are trained and the data on which they are trained. So could you just describe the process of developing these systems?
Excellent. So we started, we decided we wanted to build something. And so at the very beginning, we obviously had nothing. And so it's hard to go to a hospital and say we have something. So we basically built our own lab. We bought hospital beds and hospital equipment. We hired actors. And we started training the model on basic things. We trained on basic movement, basic exits and entries of beds, et cetera. So we used that to kind of bootstrap, a basic version of the system. But we were not comfortable with ever placing that in front of a commercial customer. So then we entered into research partnerships. So Duke, OHSU, UCSF are three research partners where we have published or presented work with them. So that started, and for the next 2 years, through the ups and downs and trials and tribulations of COVID, we ran these research studies that let us take our AI and look at just the AI aspect of what we were doing to try to understand, are we detecting the patient? Can we say that they're alone or not? Are we detecting movement? How do we set that? How does room environment and camera placement affect those pieces? So we went through about 2 years of just looking at the AI in retrospect, through research studies that affected no clinical care pathways for patients. And at the same time, we started building the software and the hardware to make this low cost and ubiquitous for hospitals so that they didn't have to pay $10,000 a room for hardware and they had software that would work in many scenarios. And then once those research studies started to show and train the data in ways that we were more comfortable with, we started injecting that AI models into this product itself. And then we commercially started rolling out last year.
Now, these kind of clinical studies can be very expensive to run, right? So how did you secure funding to start yourselves off?
Yeah, so a few things. Like in many cases, we were working with collaborators that had research funds. We are in the process of applying for research funding. This research step that I described is never ending. We did very, very specific aims on the initial research that was not... our targets were things like, can we better understand delirium? But our measurements were around, can we measure movement of patient in bed with a camera? And so essentially, we took the first steps and invested ourselves and through our investors to do that. And then we found research collaborators who had similar and overlapping interests so that they could apply their attention. So for example, people that had studied wearables in the hospital were very attracted to what we're doing because wearables have a lot of merit, but you got to put something on patients. It's hard to scale them. The idea of passive monitoring was very compelling to them. So we found folks that had related research interests that were compelled by the vision, and then we invested ourselves. And that's ongoing. We have multiple grants we're applying for right now. We have more and more sophisticated aims that we're trying to look into to understanding how this AI nudging can affect different clinical workflows.
Now, if I think about my... This is a kind of funny question in a way, but if I think about myself and if I have a good night's sleep and a bad night's sleep, I'm not quite sure whether I would move more or less during a good mm-hmm. night's sleep or a bad night's sleep. I mean, I can imagine also if somebody moves very little, maybe they're in some semi-comatose or something. No. Or is it, so what can you get out of movement measurements during the night?
You have an excellent point, and it's one of the reasons why AI without context is a bad idea for most of healthcare. Because if you try to, if we tried to get all of that context into our AI solutions, we would be researching for another 3 or 4 years. And we're doing some of that. But we thought we had information and signal now that was valuable, but we didn't have context. So the human side of this has context. So the human, the virtual nurse, knows what drugs they're on. They know what their condition is, how that normally affects patterns that we're looking for. And so they can look at our data differently. In general, if you're moving around a ton in the middle of the night, you're getting less sleep. We are not a sleep study. We're a proxy for agitation and movement. And in general, the pattern holds that more movement in the middle of the night at different patterns is a worse night of sleep. And we can show, was it a peak hour that was off? Was it a constant average level of activity? What was the magnitude and duration of that activity? So those factors come in to help the clinician, along with what they have, to understand, is this off norm or not? for this kind of patient. We can tell you we've watched thousands of your patients and have thousands of nights and how this differs from the normal night in the hospital. And then their experience starts to say, is that normal deviation part of this patient's journey, or is that something I should think about and look at more carefully?
Okay, all right, good. Let me ask you the very, very crucial question of how well your systems work and what kind of evidence you can present to people to show that.
Yeah, normally what we do is a couple things. So the studies that we're still running are grand. Like, do we affect fall rate or do we affect care costs? Those are ongoing. We have no claims we can make right now against them. However, the AI systems are validated. We have information and we can tell you that we're, you know, 90 plus percent on patient movement detection, or 95 plus percent is the patient alone or not, which is core for a lot of safety considerations. So the individual AI metrics we have generic results that we can present for that. However, and this, you should have the skepticism of anybody who gives you numbers, two things. First of all, patient alone. Where specificity sensitivity 95 plus percent, that's not good enough because you have a lot of false positives, number one. Number two, every time we go into a new hospital environment, we learned that we would see a dip in performance. And so we're deployed in 8 hospitals today. And so the second and third, we started seeing dips in performance. And so we had to kind of retrain and get back to that level. So we are seeing less dips now. So environment matters. Point three is we understand very precisely. We have a tolerance range of camera placement. We would like to look at the patient straight on, and you can move the camera to the right, you know, 20, 30 degrees, to the left, 20, 30 degrees. But if you start moving it more than that, our accuracy falls very quickly. So there's a big difference between in a lab in a perfect condition, me telling you that we can be 95% and my competitor saying they can be 99% versus saying in a real world in your setting right now, what does it look like? So every time we deploy, we basically run every week metrics against our model performance so that we can give a hospital that report and show, hey, we normally expect 95%, right? You're now you're at 97 or you're at 91. And this is what this means. In general, because we're nudging attention, not sending somebody to the room, they're less sensitive to that because they are like, is the nudging working? And that will work even at lower thresholds of performance in things like these individual metrics. So that's how we think about performance overall right now and where we're at least one of them. And we have similar methodology to evaluate all of our primitive AI capabilities and the metrics they're producing.
Okay, but you're working towards the situation where if a hospital, for example, says to you, look, show me evidence that this saves lives or it reduces hospital times,
yes,
or whatever, then you can have a robust response to that kind of question.
Absolutely. So our first deployments were last year, mid last year, and we expect to answer questions like you just added in a way that we would feel comfortable with. Those studies will take 2 or 3 years. So even though we'll be running, I think our customers will believe that they've seen impact, we'll show them metrics. It'll be a series of times before we've done that in a way that we feel like is generalizable, not just specific. So what I'll expect to happen is our customers are seeing benefit right now. And the big benefits they're seeing right now is either a reduction in things like fall rates or reduction in staffing pressure on monitoring patients. So those are metrics our customers are experiencing right now. And then we're looking to turn those into more general studies that start to make broader claims. But we want to be thorough about that because it's such an important topic to have a commentary on.
Okay. So could you give some kind of indication of how far you have rolled out these kind of systems?
Sure. So we're in 8 hospitals today. And the first set of scenarios that most of these hospitals are looking at is around virtual sitting or safety. Many times in the hospital, about 5% of the patients are monitored with somebody just sitting in the room. And it's not a nurse, it's not a doctor, it's just somebody sitting in the room. And their sole purpose is to remind you to stay in bed because you're in a hospital and I want to make sure you don't fall. Because falls are economically important to hospitals and they're obviously very important to the patient's prognosis. So the normal model is you put a person in every room. There's existing solutions that have virtualized that. It's almost a security camera-like function. And then what we do is say, we'll do that, but we'll also have the AI say, I'm going to nudge your attention towards the patients that are alone and moving in the rooms so that you can more effectively do that. So that's something we've rolled out at all 8 hospitals and is starting to have real implications on things like cost per for monitoring falls for that. The second scenario is virtual nursing, where they're using most of the time they're using our low cost hardware to do telemedicine for admissions and discharges. And we're just getting to these scenarios and evidence gathering around, hey, let me show you all the patients that are not moving very much in the middle of the day or moving a ton in the middle of the night. So you can think of things about rest and recovery or pressure injury. So that's just now beginning at those hospitals.
Great. And what about deployment in the home? What kind of studies have you done on that?
We have not, and partly because this is where I think it's really important for AI to be focused. We trained our AI to work in hospital rooms. Mm-hmm. So that we think will translate into LTAC, long-term acute care facilities, because they're basically hospitals. It could even translate to hospital at home, watching someone in a bedroom. But we have not validated or trained our AI to watch you in the kitchen or getting the way into the bathroom. And in fact, I think the sensitivity to video there is also very high. So I would say at this point, we're not focused on home solutions. We're focused on acute care settings, whether they be in hospitals, which is 99% of them, or eventually hospital at home. But we're not a general purpose solution for watching, you know, elderly parents aging and the like. We think that there's better solutions in the market that are more focused for that.
Okay, well, let's talk about some problems that you've had, because it sounds like I'm sure you must have faced a lot of challenges, right, trying to get this kind of technology up and running. Can you talk about the kind of challenges that you have faced?
Yes, I think the number one challenge that I alluded to is where and how is our camera placed in the room and how does that affect our AI performance? Because it would be easy if we could say it's always going to be in, you know, 9 feet away from the patient in the bed, and here's the results. That would be very easy for us on a relative basis on all the AI pieces. But that's not reflective of what real-world deployments look like. Room configurations are different. They're all sizes and shapes. And so the act of making sure and understanding when our AI is robust and when it's not and helping communicate that is a fundamental and structural problem of that. Number two is, it's a humbling admission to say we need to design systems that are human plus AI, that our AI is not good enough today to fully take over a task. And that is something that has been really, really a barrier, because now we have to really understand how nurses and doctors work, how they use telemedicine in the hospital, how and where we can use our AI to help them and not to upset them because we're just another false alarm piece. So it's required us to think about the clinical workflow way more deeply than if we were saying, hey, every time the patient does this, we're just gonna page you and you go to the room and we're gonna tell you what to do. That will happen someday, but just like self-driving cars, it's not ready right now. And so those are the two most significant issues that we've had in deployments today.
That makes perfect sense. Another question I have to ask is that whenever people hear about AI systems that are monitoring you, they will start thinking about Big Brother society.
Yep.
Is this a privacy a concern that comes up?
Yes, it is. I think COVID and cameras mitigated that a little bit. I could give you a bunch of technical answers, like how we do AI on the edge and data doesn't leave, how hospitals can choose to store data, blur the data, not store data, et cetera. But the real essence of what we found when we talk to patients and families is people are stunned that they're not monitored. So the hospital is the one place in the world that I want people paying attention to me all the time. Like, my mom's experience is not unusual. Moments matter, seconds matter, and staffing is constrained. So the fact is, people want their loved ones to be watched and cared for when they're at the most sensitive part of their, you know, their healthcare journey. And then we've done some things to make that even more obvious. Like, hospitals can turn on the ability for our telemedicine access to be provided to patients' families. So in my case, they could have said, they were using LookDeep, hey, between 6 and 10 p.m., you can actually video visit your mom directly without having to even call us or ask for that. So there's things we're doing to make it more of a solution for the patient and their ecosystem. But I think the macro point is, this is a hospital. It's acute care settings. You want to be watched. You want to be cared for. And that's what we've leaned into. And patients have been very receptive to that.
Excellent. Well, Narinder, I think you've given a fantastic account. And I kind of feel like I've fired quite a lot of challenging questions at you. And I think you've given a brilliant account. Last question is, is the question I ask all my guests, and that is, what is your favorite current example of medical AI that's got nothing to do with your own company?
So there's two researchers who are world-class researchers and innovative. The two professors at Sendel Mullanathan and Ziad Obermeyer, one medical doctor, one machine learning economics expert, and they have done some of the most remarkable research. And in full disclosure, they're advisors of the company now. The study that I like it because they break counter trends. So they did a study on ECG and stress testing in emergency rooms, and are we over testing? But over testing is played out. Everybody talks about over testing. What they used is looked at models and prediction to show patient populations where we were over testing and under testing, because the real world is more nuanced than we were just testing too much. Turns out we were testing not too much or too little, but just unaligned from where optimal might have been. And so they showed, here's actionable ways of translating that analysis into patients you should test more and patients you might want to test less. So their research in that area and similar ones you may have heard of, they did a well-known paper on how risk algorithms had racial implications inside of them. They've done research on how the last 2 weeks of care costing so much seems like an obvious talking point, but the real talking point is it's almost impossible to predict who's in their last 2 weeks. And so therefore, all the discussion is misplaced. So they're my favorite group of researchers, probably yeah. because they're really focused on things that make a difference to practice right now and can be applied, even though they're academic researchers.
Just going to this example of ECG, I mean, what people might be asking, what is the problem with overtesting with ECG? I mean, apart from wasting resources, but other than that, is there a problem?
Yeah, in general, what happens, the criticism of overtesting is it's not just that you're costing more money, which, by the way, has real implications on the healthcare system and ability to provide care to the patients that really need it. But the other thing is sometimes this overtesting leads to further interventions that themselves have risk. So all of a sudden, you did that, then you did, a CT scan, you do another scan, you're adding radiation. Oh, the complication rate might be 1% from this other procedure, but you just subjected a patient to a risk of a more serious injury when they had nothing wrong with them to begin with. So there's the cost implication and the equity of care, and there's also the cost of potential risk to the patients for unneeded interventions.
Good. Well, look, Narinder, I've really enjoyed the discussion very much. And as I said right at the beginning, to me, this is a really fascinating example of kind of left field medical AI. So sincere good wishes for LookDeep Health, and I wish you all the best.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much for your time, Felix.
Thanks, Narinder. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. I'm Felix Beecher. Ping me on LinkedIn for more information on Omdia's services in healthcare technology. See you next time.